This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. This story contains sounds from a military training exercise and may be upsetting to some listeners. On Wednesday, a bomb squad from Wilmington was called in to destroy an improvised explosive device found in a vacant home in Surf City. The bomb, made up of car flares, a battery pack, and wine bottles containing a liquid, was detonated in a nearby field. Even though this explosive device was easily identifiable, U.S. military and hostile countries have been on the lookout for these deadly and disfiguring devices in not-so-obvious places while conducting their missions. Knowing how to maneuver in an IED-laden environment can save lives, and the Camp Lejeune Marine Corps Engineer School's Defeat the Device training is teaching those vital skills to deploying troops. Operations Officer Lieutenant Greg Marchlinsky says the U.S. Marine Corps has found and cleared more than 13,000 homemade explosive devices from 2007 to 2011 in foreign countries.
So it's not just deal with the IED, but continue conducting your mission and your operations in that environment with an ability to then reduce the effect of that weapon system on your operations.
260,000 troops have received counter-IED training at sites in California, at 29 Palms and Camp Pendleton, and here in eastern North Carolina at Camp Lejeune. The 55-acre training lane in Holly Ridge opened in 2011 and includes two mock Afghani villages, several training ranges, and more than 2 miles of road where Marines can practice identifying potential threats while on convoy. The compound also includes classrooms where counter-IED instructor George Frick prepares Marines for what they may face in combat situations and how to appropriately respond.
On deck right now training, we have 18 with the Georgia liaison team that are going over to the Republic of Georgia, and they're being advisors with the Georgians whenever they move into Afghanistan.
On October 1st, I met with officials from Camp Lejeune's Engineer School for a site tour to learn more about IED training. Around 10 a.m., the day started with a briefing, and the team dismisses to the training lanes to implement skills learned in the classroom. During this foot patrol, the group will encounter small arms fire and multiple IEDs. Captain Dylan Baker with the Georgia liaison team says the two-day training will be invaluable.
These guys are in contact with on a regular basis with units in country and getting the most relevant and up-to-date TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures that the enemy is using, and bringing them to this environment and getting us as much immersed as possible before we deploy. So it's a huge confidence booster for us.
The term crawl, walk, run is often heard in the training lane. It's a metaphor describing the increasing difficulty of tasks to come. Site lead for mobile training Craig Yohi says the Georgia liaison team will encounter three scenarios. The first, a hoax IED.
The purpose of a hoax IED is multifaceted, okay? And so the first thing you have to ask yourself, a hoax IED being an IED that's very obvious. So you have to ask yourself, as far from an enemy standpoint, what is he trying to understand about me right now? All right, did he just poorly place a device in haste, or is he wanting to see how I react?
Distant machine gun and heavy artillery fire rings in the background as the 18-member unit cautiously walks along the pine tree-lined road. Up ahead, one of the Marines spots an exposed orange tripwire in their path. When the IED is spotted, the unit immediately checks the 5 to 25-meter area around the known IED for a secondary device. With the reaction drill completed and security positions established, the exercise stops, and the Marines gather for a debriefing led by instructor Chad Graff.
Did anybody do good 5s and 25s prior to getting down in their security position? Let's be honest here.
Not good enough. I was behind Doc, though.
Okay, no. Well, I don't think we ever want to say not good enough. Do we think we might have been able to identify that secondary device had we done good 5s and 25s, though? You get where I'm going.
With the crawl stage behind them, the unit proceeds to the next training site, the walk stage. The Marines march quietly an eighth of a mile up the paved road to a mock village, similar to one you'd see in Afghanistan or Iraq. The uninhabited town includes stucco houses, a stoplight, parked vehicles, and signs in Arabic. The unit searches in and around the buildings, behind concrete block walls, and a suspiciously placed market cart. A Marine, dressed in camouflage, wearing combat gear, and carrying a semi-automatic rifle, signals that he's found a laboratory in one of the buildings. Defeat the Device Branch Chief, Master Sergeant James Paul, says the setup inside, nitrogen fertilizer bags, beakers, hot plates, and wire, simulate what a homemade explosive lab looks like and prepares Marines to identify them quickly.
It's not always this in-depth. It's not always this elaborate. Sometimes you'll be patrolling through an area or you'll be in an area where you just see something that you know doesn't belong. How many Afghans really need a bottle of hydrogen peroxide? The black jug with the red lid, typically that is hydrochloric acid. At least that's the bottle that comes in stock, for lack of a better term. But if you see something like that, you need to understand that that is an indicator or a precursor to an HME.
After the unit identifies the homemade explosive lab, they radio the location to headquarters and move further up the road. One of the Marines is inspecting a culvert when a practice IED suddenly goes off. Playing the part, the Marine pretends to be injured. Two unit Marines grab his feet and vest and carry him to a safe place where they radio for evacuation. Site lead for mobile training Craig Yohe says they encourage units to practice TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures during the training scenarios.
And that includes casualty evacuation, that includes establishing landing zones, and a whole bunch of other efforts, activating a QRF, quicker action force to respond to support them. So we encourage them as they begin to leave the crawl phase and enter the walk and run phase to begin to incorporate all those actions, because that's certainly what they'll be doing in real time.
As their comrade is carried to safety, other Marines take security positions and look for additional threats. The second training phase now complete, the unit debriefs. Next is the run phase of training. The Marines silently walk the gravel road away from the village, scanning ditches, looking in trees, and inspecting the ground for places an IED could be buried. The unit grinds to a halt.
You gotta pass that brevity code, okay? Everyone's gotta be aware of what's going on, why we're stopping at this point, all right?
Today's brevity code word is banana. The code is used to alert the unit to a potential threat without drawing too much attention. If there's a dramatic shift in the unit's reaction, a nearby enemy could detonate the IED. This stoppage is a false alarm. The team continues cautiously forward and splits, some patrolling the gravel road, some searching the ditch. In this simulation, an IED explosion injures a Marine and triggers a chain of events. Reacting, some members of the team maintain their security positions, another assists the injured person, and another radios for a medevac.
Right leg, shrapnel to the upper torso. Hemorrhaging from the right leg, unconsciousness. Treatment rendered, tourniquet applied.
Contact front! Direct front!
Machine gun fire echoes through the woods up the road.
On front, sir!
That last explosion is a second IED going off behind the team. A Marine is lying next to the device when it detonates. Operations Officer Lieutenant Colonel Greg Marchlinsky.
They should be sweeping up to him and then conducting the same. So you have basically two casualty evacuations going on right now. So one at the front end, one at the back end, also with obviously a machine gun attack at the front.
Machine gun fire persists.
50 meters!
Some Georgia liaison members stay with the wounded. Others move forward to eliminate the threat. But the medevac process is taking too long.
Incoming!
Now the sound of mortar rounds adds to the confusion and chaos.
I need help moving this casualty.
When the training exercise is completed, the group huddles for one last debriefing.
I saw the major a couple times, and I think it was right here, sir, with the pink tape.
Yeah.
I saw you. He paid attention to it really heavily and then started to look around for other indicators.
Yeah, I just didn't
That's
find
perfect.
I didn't find anything else, and it said, you know, water or wetlands or whatever. So I was like, well, somebody's been out here to put this up here. But
certainly. But initially, it was a baseline deviation.
Yeah.
You know, there's no other telephone pole we've passed
that has a pink,
that has any pink tape wrapped around
it. That was the other thing, is that I saw the blue paint markings, and I meant to say something to Milad on that, but.
So
I saw it.
The good thing is that we picked up on all those indicators.
The Georgia liaison team completed their training the first week of October and have since returned to the Republic of Georgia, where they'll advise troops as they move into Afghanistan. To see photos from my October 1st report, visit publicradioeast.org.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Down East Journal on PRE, Public Radio East. I'm Kelly Batchelor here with Jared Brumbaugh. What an exciting story. What great audio. We felt like we were there. And that's one of the special things about Down East Journal. Not only do you feel like you're in the story, it's always a story happening here in Eastern North Carolina. And your pledge is making that possible. The Down East Journal is a program you can't hear anywhere else but Public Radio East. It's important that Jared and our other contributors to Down East Journal have the funds that it takes to get the story to you and to put a spotlight on Eastern North Carolina. And that's really what Down East Journal is all about. We're asking you to make your pledge now at publicradioeast.org. Had some fantastic stories, Jared, recently about rice plantations in southeastern North Carolina. And one of my favorites was the shelter opening for male victims of human trafficking.
A very, very popular story at our website, getting lots of hits there. And on Twitter, we got retweeted by national nonprofit organizations that are dealing with human trafficking every day as part of their mission, as part of their organization. We've also heard stories last week about the crab trap cleanup project planned for this winter on the coast. You hear such a variety of stories here on the Down East Journal, and that's what your pledge pays for.
They all have one thing in common, though. They're local stories with a spotlight on Eastern North Carolina issues. It's important that you support this program and Public Radio East with a pledge. If you are not currently a member of Public Radio East, if you have not made a pledge this year, renew your membership or become a new member right now in any amount. Any amount makes you a member at publicradioeast.org and make a pledge to keep Down East Journal on the air here on Public Radio East.
Next weekend, the New Bern Historical Society is putting on their 24th annual Ghost Walk, which includes 17 ghost sites and homes and businesses in New Bern's historic district. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the Ghost Walk. This week, Mac McKee speaks with director Lynn Herrickle about this year's event.
Lynn, good afternoon, and thanks for being a guest today on the Down East Journal.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Now, of course, it's that bewitching time of year again, and it's time for the 24th annual Ghost Walk. Now, I believe the theme is Haunting with Attitude. Now, how did the New Bern Historical Society decide on this year's theme?
Back through history, we realized that attitude has played a very large part in how decisions have been made and how history has actually been formed. So we decided to play upon that, and all of our ghosts have attitude this year.
Now, you say it's the 24th annual one. Which ghost walk is this for you, Lynn?
This is my seventh ghost walk.
Tell our listeners, without giving away all the, you know, ghoulish details, if you will, about some of the haunted highlights this year.
Sure. We've got great spirits throughout. There's a very fun and entertaining one will be over at the First Presbyterian Session House, where we're going to be having the 1932 Women's Club meeting to discuss having a building built for the Women's Club at Union Point Park to clean up Union Point Park, because at that point Union Point Park had actually not been a park but had been a dump for the city. So that one's going to be a lot of fun, very entertaining. We also have over at St. Peter's AME Zion Bishop Hood, who was the founder of St. Peter's AME Zion Church here in New Bern, and he was also very active at King Solomon Lodge Number 1, which will also be on Ghost Walk as well.
And I suppose with New Bern's history from 1710, that the centuries are very well represented.
They are. And on the ticket, we will indicate what the time period is of that particular ghost.
What is Agony Alley, and can you give us some of the historical perspective and significance of the Atmore Oliver House?
Agony Alley is located at the Atmore Oliver House. Agony Alley is a more playful venue for Ghost Walk. It is not based on any specific history of New Bern. It's more of just a fun, funny, almost zany kind of venue. And we have had for the last 2 years a storyline that has been based around a fictitious bakery called The Very Good Bakery. And this year, again, it will be based around some of the characters that we've developed are associated with this Very Good Bakery. The Atmore Oliver House has actually been around for centuries now, and it was purchased by Isaac Taylor for his daughter. Isaac Taylor is connected to the James Taylor family as the great-great-great-grandfather of James Taylor. So that's kind of the very first prominent family that lived here at the Atmore Oliver House, and the Atmore Oliver House had actually been expanded over the years. And then eventually it went into decline and was purchased by the New Bern Historical Society in the 1950s, at which point we had renovated the house, and we are in the process of doing additional renovations on the house right now.
I know every ghost walk features a walk through the cemetery. What about this year?
Yes, there will definitely be a walk through the cemetery. And, of course, you always have to be careful walking through the weeping arched gate, because if you are dripped upon by that, then you are the next person that's going into the cemetery feet first, if you catch my drift there. They will start off just inside of the cemetery gate. Very dark, a little bit eerie, but is not going to be scary. It's appropriate for all ages.
What are the dates of this year's Ghost Walk, and where can folks pick up tickets, Lynn?
Ghost Walk is October 23rd to the 25th, which is a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Tickets can be purchased online at the New Bern Historical Society's website, which is newbernhistorical.org. Tickets can also be purchased at Harris Teeter in New Bern, Harris Teeter in Moorhead City, ASAP Photo in Greenville, and then also in New Bern at Bank of the Arts, Mitchell Hardware, and at the Convention Center.
Lynn, thank you for joining us on Downey's Journal today.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me to be part of this. Appreciate it.
You're listening to the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh, along with Kelly Batchelor, and we're asking you to do your part to support local journalism stories about Eastern North Carolina for Eastern North Carolina with your pledge online at publicradioeast.org.
I know that every once in a while, Jared, you get on the road to fulfill your mission here, keeping Downeast Journal fresh each week.
Yeah.
And I love to hear those real-time stories, you know, those actualities out in the real world. One I remember distinctly was a recent story you did on the new Leash on Life program from the Craven Correctional Institution about trying to train dogs that need adoption and then getting them adopted out. It was a heartwarming story. We heard from the inmates. We heard from the people who supervise the inmates. We even heard from the animals in the story. And it was really fun to listen to, but it was a worthwhile project. And that's what Public Radio East is here for, and Downeast Journal in particular, to put a spotlight on Eastern North Carolina issues.
It's your pledge that makes that happen. So if you enjoy having access to these stories, make that pledge online at publicradioeast.org. A pledge of $100 is going to go a long way in supporting the programs you love, including the Downeast Journal, and we'll send you the PRE member card as a thank you gift for doing your part. The PRE member card, good for two-for-one dining at restaurant locations across eastern North Carolina.
And two-for-one green fees at area golf courses. And Jared, I just recently took some golf lessons, so I'm going to be using that part of my member card. And really, that will save you a lot of money if you like to play casually, if you like to eat out casually in eastern North Carolina. But that $100 pledge at publicradioeast.org comes to Public Radio East. We put it into the programming budget so that we can send you out on wonderful stories that you'll cover on Downeast Journal, so that you can hear the news programs you enjoy, like Morning Edition and All Things Considered, so you can hear the programs on the weekends that enlighten and entertain you, like This American Life.
Pledge online at publicradioeast.org. You know, when you listen to the Downeast Journal, you're hearing award-winning feature reports in addition to receiving Associated Press Awards. Two of our features that we aired here during the summer have been printed in statewide publications, the News and Observer of Raleigh, the Charlotte Observer, and distributed across the state. At Public Radio East, we strive to bring you current news and information that's compelling, that's entertaining, that's informative, and you have a part in this too. Your pledge makes it happen. So make that pledge at publicradioeast.org, and thank you so much.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. As I'm out and in the garden, I'm looking at the leaves starting to fall, pulling up my vegetable garden from the summer, pulling out my flower gardens from the summer. And now is a great time of year to be putting together a compost pile. We can take all of those great debris from the garden, those last couple of grass clippings for the season, and build a system that we can use to generate some really gorgeous compost to enrich our gardens next year. So what can we put in the compost bin? Leaves from deciduous trees, the sorts of leaves that are falling at this point in the year. Grass clippings, as long as our lawn wasn't treated with any sort of herbicides or pesticides. Shredded woody debris, so if you have small twigs and limbs that come down and have a little shredder, you can run them through the shredder so they'll break down more quickly in the pile. Of course, the plant debris from your vegetable and flower gardens, the sorts of annual plants or herbaceous plants that you're cutting back at this point in the season, and your kitchen scraps, fruits and vegetable peels, crushed eggshells, tea bags, coffee grounds are all really great additions to the compost pile. But we do need to make sure that we keep some things out. Things like meats and bones, fatty or oily foods, dairy products, those will cause problems in the composting system and they can draw pests in. And we also want to make sure that we don't include anything like cat or dog waste because those pose a human health issue. So we're going to keep those things out of the compost bin. Other than that, most of what comes out of our yard and garden is going to be fair game. A lot of people think that they need a fancy-dancy compost bin to start composting. But the reality is that we're just accelerating the natural decay process. So this isn't really complicated stuff. We're letting things rot, which they already want to do. And if a compost bin helps you to manage your compost pile, that's great. But you can take about a 12-foot long piece of hardware cloth or woven wire and just bend it around in a circle, clip it together with a couple of snaps, and that'll help keep your compost pile in one place while you turn it. Once you have your wire bin in place, we're just going to layer alternating layers of browns and greens. Browns are carbon-rich plant material, things like shed leaves. And greens are nitrogen-rich plant material, things like fresh grass clippings. And you're just going to alternate layers of greens and browns in your compost pile so that your little microorganisms have both plenty of carbon and nitrogen to work with as they're breaking down your debris. If you turn your pile, it will compost more quickly. So you can turn your pile every 5 to 7 days for the first month, and that'll accelerate the process. If you don't turn your pile, that's okay. It's just that what's on the bottom of the pile is going to break down faster, and what's on the top of the pile is going to break down much more slowly. Once your compost is finished, you want to let it age for about another month before you apply it around your plant material. So a really well-managed bin will produce compost in about 4 weeks, and then you're going to let it age for 4 weeks. And then in the spring, you'll have great home-raised compost that you can apply around your trees, shrubs, or work into the top part of your new planters to help feed your plants next season.
This is PRE Public Radio East. We're inside the Fall Fun Drive 2014. You've heard a lot of things on Down East Journal today, but we hope you have heard our appeal on behalf of your public radio station, Public Radio East, to make your membership current. If you've never made a pledge before, now is the time. At publicradioeast.org, we have a secure, easy web form you can fill out. But your pledge today means that for the next 6 months, we can bring you all of the programs, including Down East Journal, that you love, that you tune in for, and that you expect from Public Radio East.
Make a pledge at publicradioeast.org. Each week on the Down East Journal, we like to keep you informed on news and information that's happening across the region. Recently, we reported on the solar project planned in eastern North Carolina.
We also talked about a study exploring the potential for offshore energy development and how expanding Highway 70 to interstate standards could improve the area economically. We tried to touch on everything that's important in eastern North Carolina, and when you really think about it, there are a lot of issues important to eastern North Carolina. We'd love to be able to expand this program to a one-hour program, but of course, it all comes down to funds. So let's fully fund Public Radio East and the Downeast Journal for the next 6 months with your pledge of support now in any amount. We can't stress that enough. If you want to make a $50 pledge or a $100 pledge or a $1,000 Barker Leadership Circle pledge, we certainly would welcome any amount because it all means you're doing your part. So membership starts when you make your pledge on an annual basis at publicradioeast.org. I hope you're the next person to make a pledge today.
Your pledge at publicradioeast.org ensures that this quality news journalism will continue in Eastern North Carolina. Where else can you get in-depth feature reports like the ones you hear on Downeast Journal? What other news organizations would spend several minutes discussing these issues in depth? These are the reasons why you listen to the Downeast Journal, and these should be the same reasons you support it as well. Make a pledge at publicradioeast.org. And thanks.